My name is Janice Goodman, and I'm here for 15 teaching sessions. And Elmer asked me to talk about the history, culture, faith, spirituality of Native Americans. And that goes along with the ministry that I have with the Lutheran Church. I work for the Pacific Northwest Synod of the LCA and the North Pacific District of the ALC. And so, how to go about that, how to gear it to a group of people where you may come in once and you may come in many times. How many people have been here before? David? Okay. And have you had more than one session with me? Anybody? You've had two. Okay. Okay. So maybe, and yet, how do you put something together that's interesting for all those who participate in the tape ministry? Or they might want to get a whole series on Indians. And so in preparation for talking to you, I have worked with a couple of textbooks. This particular one is American Indians and Christian Missions by Henry Warner Bowden. And this man is a professor at Rutgers University, a professor of religion. This is part of a series, a Chicago History of America, American Religion series. And it's called A Study in Cultural Conflict. I recommend it to you as a source of information that's much more detailed than what you're going to hear here. It's a thought-provoking history of Indian missions. That early relationship, since my ministry is a relationship between church people, that is Lutherans and Indians, I felt that by taking a look at what had happened in the past, I might be able to avoid some mistakes. So this is one of the books that you might be interested in. It would be in the bookstore, except that it didn't get ordered. They thought that it only would come in a cloth bound, and the cloth bound cost $15. And they don't generally order anything that costs more than $10. When they ordered it, they turned out to have a paperback, but they're on order, but they're not here yet. Okay, that's sort of introductory material. I think what I'd like to do is begin with a prayer, and then, well, maybe you can kind of be thinking about the things that come up, sort of, if you can empty your mind as we pray. And let your mind sort of lift up images of Indians or questions about Indians or your own experiences with Indians. And then after we pray, then maybe you can ask some questions. I'd like to hear what you might be hoping to get out of this time together. So you might be thinking about that. Okay? Does that sound all right? Let's stand then and face the east. I'm not doing this in the way of a traditional ritual, but it is traditional to pray to the six directions. The words that I'm using are my own original words, based on who I am and what I am. We send a vision to the east, and as we look to the east, we think about the color yellow. We think about the people of the East, the people that we have called the yellow people, the Asians, Chinese, Japanese, Polynesian, Filipino, Thai, India. So many peoples. We send a voice in this direction, towards the east. We think about the Asian, Vietnamese people who have come to this North American continent, fleeing from their life situations. We think about the second and third generation Chinese in America who came here to build railroads, to serve as cheap labor, to escape the lives that they lived in previous times. We think about the brides, wives, women who were brought home during various Asian wars, women who left all culture and came to live in this land. We send a voice to the East, and as we pray, we see our connectedness to the Asian peoples. Surely the yellow people are a part of our family. Let us turn to the South. As we turn to the South, we think of the color black. We think of the black people in our world. We think of the people in Africa, in Southern Africa, in Namibia, in Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Ethiopia, North Africa, Guyana. We think about the rich diversity, the gifts that the Africans bring. We think about those first, second, third generation blacks, Nigerians, children of slaves, children who come out of the experience of being forced into slavery. We think about those who have been free for generations, those who live a middle class existence in a secret life that has only now become available to us. We look to the direction of the South and we remember the blacks in countries all over the world. We lift up their experiences of oppression and racist hatred. And we express our solidarity, our connection to the people who are black. Surely they are our sisters and brothers. We turn to the West, and the color of the West is red. As we think of the color red, we think of our brothers and sisters who are Indian and Chicano, Mexican, Central and South American Native peoples. We think of their contributions to our world, their spirituality, their lives. We think about their names and the teachings that they have shared with us, sacredness of the land, the connectedness of all creation, the connectedness of the plant world and the animal world, the stones and the air and the water. We send a voice to the West and we name and celebrate the red people, the Mexican people, the brown people, the people all over our land, all over this world. Surely they are our brothers and sisters. We turn to the North. The color of the North is white, and we send a voice celebrating the precious lives of our brothers and sisters who trace their heritage to the Caucasian cultures and histories. We celebrate the gifts of the Norwegian and Swedish, Danish and Irish, the English and French and German. We celebrate the courage and tenacity, the perseverance and vision. We celebrate the ingenuity and rational education that has been a gift to the whole world, given freely in the hands of those who are our white brothers and sisters. We celebrate the energy and vitality, the dream, the rich heritage of literature and art that is a gift to the whole world. Surely those who are white are our brothers and sisters. And we face the East again, and we look at our own selves, and we name our own name and celebrate our own gifts. We accept whatever racial heritage we have. We accept whatever mix we are. We reach out to ourselves with acceptance of our backgrounds, our culture, our language past. Surely there was a reason for what we are. Surely there was planning and preparation that made our lives what they are. And we celebrate our own existence. And as we look up, we think about the Creator, the Spirit, the flame that burns in our hearts and the hearts of our brothers and sisters. We think about the energy that connects us, the love that not only embraces us personally, but is here in this room, wrapping us with tender acceptance. And as we feel that love spread throughout this room and radiate out, we send a voice of love to those peoples all over the world who are surely our brothers and sisters. Amen. I really appreciate your being here. And I'm sort of changing the format from somewhat of a lecture motif, which I started with, because the end of this book is, I think, maybe a little more adaptable to a question and answer process. I would like to hear from you. What are your questions? What are your interests? What would you like to get in the next 45 minutes? Is there a particular Indian group that you're interested in? Yes.
I'd like to have you tell us something about the Dakota Indians. Rather than have us share our ignorance.
Okay.
You tell us what you know. Lest we confuse each other with what we don't know.
The religion of the Indian.
Okay.
I'm from Western Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the Puyallup tribe is the tribe that's closest to us. And about all I know about the Puyallup tribe is smoke shops and bingo halls. And I would like to have that expanded.
Any other questions you want to ask? If you think of one as we go along, you might raise your hand. I did want to talk a little bit about the Dakota people today. The history that I've been presenting in the form of a journey on an eagle's back, a sense of inviting you to imagine yourself able to move around in physical space and back and forward in time. And I began with an invitation for people to climb on the back of an eagle with me and sort of soar back to the original peoples of this land. I've been talking a little bit about dancing, about it being a spiral dance as well. You are wherever you are in your journey of life. And it is a journey, it is a motion. It is a stepping out. You are going, you're not standing still in one place. You are in motion. Your life is moving, and all of our lives are moving. And I've been learning a little bit about Matthew Fox, and he talked, he was at the convention, not this, before I came here, the LCA convention in the Pacific Northwest. And I asked him, he'd been talking several hours in different formats. And I asked him a question. I said, if you could tell us what you're trying to tell us without any words, what would you do? What is your nonverbal expression of what he was trying to tell us, a creation-centered spirituality? And he immediately began to bring everybody into a spiral dance. But just, what is a spiral dance? Because I've been kind of imaging the story of Indians in the form of a spiral dance. A spiral dance would be where you can visualize joyful, energetic people taking hands and being connected to each other, not in a hierarchical way, but in a not in a linear way, but in a connectedness, beginning with a circle and one person stepping out and leading the people into a spiral that goes into the center. And if you can just visualize that, you see these faces, real people passing by near to you, and different, not the same, but you know, just kind of look around the room and just kind of visualize us starting to move in a spiral, and you see faces and big and little and, you know, Scandinavian and dark hair, and you see real people start to come around, and you get close, and you're actually touching. Nobody is not connected to somebody else. And in fact, if you visualize our experience as a spiral dance, we're all connected to each other. And so I've been sort of, imagine yourself sort of going around and then working your way into the middle. And then as you get to the middle, you kind of make a little turn and you go outward again. And I think as you listen to me, if you can sort of in your own self go back in time to maybe the early images that you have about Indians or any experiences that you've had, and that's kind of a swing into the personal. And then as you listen to my words, we might swing back in time to a tribe or a group, or I might take you like to the Dakotas to experience Dakota people, the Sioux people. And that's sort of out there, away from your own experience, kind of different. So as you're listening, you sort of bring it back in and you say, what is it, what am I doing, what's happening to me as I listen to this? What am I feeling, what images are coming up? And think of us as sort of being in a dance with each other. So I wanted to talk then about the Dakota people, and then I'll try to get to something about the Puyallup for you, and hopefully share something about religion. Originally, there were established groups of people all over. As I said, just to briefly kind of go back, there were peoples everywhere in every ecological system across the North American continent. There were original indigenous peoples. There were peoples who developed cultures, diverse cultures. And the series that I've been working on has lifted up some of those cultures. There are the unique cultures of the Southwest, the Pueblos, the people who build with them mud and stick and stone up against the sandstone, people who have a farming agriculture, people who existed in virtually the same form for thousands of years, people with a complicated religion, a complicated and sophisticated structure of societies, people who had a cosmology, a world vision. Distinct and unique, as you are thinking about the people in Arizona and New Mexico, if you've ever seen like the pottery of the Pueblos. You ever seen that clay pottery or Maria San Ildefonso? You know, maybe that's a personal experience that you can bring to that. Have you ever seen a Kachina doll? That is a kind of an Indian image from the Southwest. And I'm not going to go back over that territory because I've already talked about that. But to begin to say this about Indians, that they're so different and diverse, that if I started talking about the Pueblo and the southwestern cultures, and then as we continued our journey, our spiral, and maybe moved, and the next day I talked about the Great Lakes region, the Huron, the Wendat, the Pequot, another totally different culture, very different a culture that is responsive to an ecology, a culture that has a world system, a way of teaching, a language very different from the Southwest. I've been talking about the qualities of the way people related to each other and related to the natural world. And then what the experience was when they were touched by the non-Indian. And then I talked about the Northeast, the Massachusetts, the Christian Indians, the Indians that adopted Christianity as a result of the missionary work of the Puritans, and what happened to them. And so we just sort of look with eagle's eyes back over that territory to know where we've been. And now we, again, if you want more information about that, you might try to get hold of this book. It's on reserve in the library. So now we come to the section which I had labeled the Dakotas. And I had been moving forward in time. And I guess I need to remind you a little bit about what's happening. That there were native peoples and this vast land. And there were governments across the sea that were in a phase of colonialism. The English, the French, the Spanish set out to go to uninhabited, so-called uninhabited, but mostly unused land in order to find those resources that they had become, that had been become scarce in Spain and England and France. And they, even before they've gone on a boat, they had a pattern set. It was going to be a certain way because they had, Gary talks about a paradigm. They had a paradigm already. They had a pattern all set. They were looking for, what were they looking for? They were looking for gold. They were looking for wealth. They were looking for land that they could put their flag down on. They were in competition with each other. And that sets a tone or a pattern for what happens, even before they get here. What they were kind of doing was racing around the world, getting their flag in to certain pieces of land. They had decided, you know, just decided that the world was round, and so I just have images of these boats just going, the way they came through, and just one winter planted a flag and stayed 2 days and moved up the coast and planted a flag, and then said, this whole territory is French, or this whole territory is English, or this whole territory is Spanish. Okay, so you have a sense of that? What people were doing? Okay. Well, by the 18th century, this process had radically altered the lives of the indigenous peoples. The first boats that landed brought with them illness. So that by the time, by the time the Plymouth colony was established, half of the native peoples who lived in that area had already been killed off by the diseases that were brought with the very first landings. They had a culture that was already established, and disease came in and weakened them before people even got there, before colonists even landed. Okay. The pattern then was that a colonist would land. Missionaries often came. The pattern that is a history that seems to be, that works as you read through these different things, is that oftentimes the first contacts involve some kind of sharing in the earliest beginning. some kind of acceptance, which rapidly degenerates into conflict. The colonists are looking for bottom land. The native peoples are used to using that land for one purpose, and there becomes conflict. Conflict degenerates into warfare, typically, or occupation, or forced relocation. And that's sort of a pattern, as we've talked, that those are the things that happen. So now we're sort of to the point where we begin with the story of the Dakotas. This pressure from the east kept moving peoples westward in order to avoid warfare, in order to avoid conflict, in order to avoid disease, in order to find food after the subsistence economy has been greatly altered. Tribes begin pushing westward. And so what happens is that the great tribes of the east, the Iroquois, the Algonquin peoples, the Huron-speaking peoples, this pressure begins pushing. Originally, those people who were originally Sioux, what we call Sioux today, the Dakota, the Lakota, and the Nakota language-speaking groups, originally, they were in the Ohio Valley. They were further east. They were a woodlands tribe ancestrally. And they lived, they had a culture that was based on the ancient archaic systems that it grew up out of the ancient woodlands cultures. It was a system that often had a semi-permanent winter home, often in the ground, had a system in the winter where the peoples spread out in clan size groups, small size family groups, to survive the winter and to carry out and have a good chance at the hunting and all of that sort of stuff. And then would concentrate into some kinds of semi-subsistence farming, where they would do some planting, they would have some crops. And then while the crops were growing, they would be harvesting. Using other natural resources that came through, like the salmon run. Most people didn't even realize it was an Atlantic salmon run. It was a fish run that came up. So, anyway, they were pushed out into the plains just about the same time as the horses introduced from the south. And we have this great explosion of cultural change because the Sioux people get the horse. And they adopt the horse it's an interesting experience, because what they were doing as a culture was they were going through a change because they were moving out of the woodlands. They were pushed onto the plains. And just the time as they're pushed onto the plains and they're doing all this adapting and changing, in comes the horse. And it makes a big difference in how they adapt. The experience of getting on the horses. I think it's meditating on the swift the creative acceptance of the horse into their life system. It's real fascinating to me as I think about it. I mean, here they had been a peoples, and here was a new revolutionary thing, and they just took it almost as a spiritual gift, it seems to me, as I read about it. It's as I hear about it, as I meditate on it, as I experience the relationships between the people and the horse. And I'll take a turn on the spiral and into a very personal perspective on this. It's fun for me to talk about the Dakota because I'm Sioux. I'm Lakota. And some of my perspective is maybe a little different. It's awesome to me because, like, some of the stories that are mine are like, there have been a practice of capturing some native peoples, putting them on ships and taking them back to Europe for display. It's sort of like a zoo experience. Some of the very first ships that made it back to Europe had Indians on them. That was not uncommon for someone to take Indians back to Europe. Well, I have a great-grandfather who was born in France, traveling through Europe with Buffalo Bill's Wild West ship when he took Indians to Europe. And I was kind of reading about that experience of what it's like to be an Indian, a people who were raised, you know, on the prairies with the horse and everything, and sort of picked up out of that culture and carried by ship and dropped in the middle of England on display to be Indians and do the things. And what they would do is they would do horseback riding demonstrations. And that history is sort of handed down in my family, so that some of the stories of my mother are of her riding bareback on two horses. And just the experience of riding a horse. It's hard for me to tell you in a way that I feel like I've communicated or translated what is for me a spiritual relationship between the Sioux people and the horse.
That doesn't exist today. What has taken it? How has it evolved?
Well, I don't know that I would say it doesn't exist today. It doesn't exist today in the same form, but I don't know.
Are they still horse people?
Well, no? It depends on the person, but depends on the tradition, but I would say there are some, definitely, who, well, how, what I have to share with you is the understanding of what it is that is sacred. Everything is sacred, you know, and I'm keying on the experience of the people and the horse, but that's just one element of sacredness.
Is that true of all the Plains Indians? You hear of the Cheyennes being the horse Indians, loving a horse, and of other tribes being very abusive to their horse and using them, you know, killing them, riding them to death. Like some Eskimos take good care of their dogs, other Eskimos do not take good care of their dogs. It's a tool for them to be used and abused.
I don't know how to answer you. Only that the experience that Indian people have had in the last two generations is an experience that's totally colored and altered by their relationships and experiences with other peoples. But that the teaching that all life is sacred, the traditional teaching, all Indians, you know, all Dakota people and Lakota people may not have been brought up in that traditional teaching. But the heart of the teaching is still the sacredness of life. Yes.
Could you
clarify Lakota, Dakota, Sioux? It sounds like it's this, are they the same? Are they different?
Okay. I was taught to name myself Lakota. There are three groups, well, there are seven, but there are three language groups of Sioux. The Lakota, which is the Western peoples, the Dakota, which is the Central peoples, and the Nakota, which are the Eastern Sioux.
Where were they located, or where are they located? Would you say in like South Dakota, Minnesota? Which groups are there?
Well, I don't know. I don't know exactly where I would draw the lines and boundaries. The Lakota peoples are the Western Sioux. My tribe is from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, so that would be Western South Dakota. As you move eastward, they speak Dakota mostly in Eastern, I think it's Eastern South Dakota, North Dakota, and through that sort of space there. And then as you move further eastward, then you have the group that would be Nakota.
Are your people still living somewhat separately? Or are they just getting all mixed up with everybody else?
Well, one of the things that you need to know about the history of Indian people is the story of a couple of stories. One of the stories has to do with some American Indian policy that decided that the thing to do with the quote Indian problem was to take the Indian out of the take the Indianness, kill the Indian, and save the man sort of concept. And so they enacted policies that moved young people out of the homes into boarding schools, and intentionally someone from South Dakota would be sent clear across the United States or down into Southwest or as far away from home as they could get.
To boarding schools.
And they were raised there and tried and kept away. Sometimes you couldn't go home. Like if you spoke your own language, you would lose the privilege of going home. And so that's one thing that happened that caused the Sioux people to be dispersed all over the country. Another thing that happened is in the 50s, a policy called relocation, where it was decided that the best way to solve the quote Indian problem was to move Indians off the reservation by moving them, lock, stock, and barrel, to a city. And so large populations of Sioux were moved to San Francisco and Seattle and all over.
It's just embarrassing to think of
Chicago, and they were just moved. You should know that this is not over. There is a forced relocation of Navajo and Hopi people going on this year. And it has been said that they would be all moved, 10,000 Navajo and Hopi people moved out of the Big Mountain area this year by July the 1st. So it's a policy that is not ended.
Does anybody who is setting those policies, have they ever thought that they were doing the Indians any favors doing this? Or was it just outright, we're doing what is convenient for us, heck with what happens to them?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think that a lot of the things, policies that were enacted about Indians were based on some good intentions. But if there is one lesson that I'd like to teach about Indians, it's that that if there's a word that's key, it's choice. I think that the issue is one of choice. That I may have the best intentions in the world, and impose upon you something which I think you need. It could be very painful, very bad for you, because I don't know everything that there is to know about you, and I may make poor decisions on your behalf. And I personally think that people need to make their own decisions about their lives. And it's part of the history of the relationship between Indians and non-Indians that decisions were made and are still being made without the impact of the peoples.
Why are they moving those peoples now? They find oil or something?
Partly, as I understand the situation, it's partly because of the mineral wealth of the region. That's one of the reasons. Another reason has to do with the process. Well, I won't say too much more about that because I'm not positive about everything that's going on down there. I haven't been down there yet, so I'm not sure. Has anybody been there? Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I don't really talk about it, but I'm trying to think where there's an excellent article. I think maybe in one of these, the other side, talking about, I say excellent, it's very educational article, trying to give background on it. There's to do with the land dispute between the Hopi and Navajos also, and how the land was originally allotted and so on with the Navajos surrounding the Hopi reservation, and one of those situations where it won't be right on either side because someone's going to lose no matter what's done. If I can think of it, I'll try to look up where that article was.
I guess I'm real reluctant to get into it because it's somewhat of an intra-tribal problem.
Yeah.
It's something that I don't get into.
Somebody who's not Indian wants the land and is kicking the Indians off.
Well,
that too.
It's not a simple problem. It's a really complicated one. Mm-hmm. But the result is a forced relocation, which is a problem to me.
Of some, for instance, Navajo peoples who've lived there for generations, but now are having to leave. Mm-hmm. The question I have, though, when we speak of who's setting the policy, it's not the same as it once was. Is it when we said government, that really was referring to a government that probably didn't include any Indian representation at all? Now, isn't it in many cases today, some of the decisions are made by the Indian councils and so on, but they are very often, I don't know if the right word is controlled or what, by outside, so there's a division among the Indians themselves that they are betrayed. Maybe it might be Indian people making the decision, but they're not necessarily speaking for the majority of Indian people. Would that be right? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a real problem. It's a real problem because, again, of historic policy. That in 1936, they passed the Indian Reorganization Act, which created a system of government, of tribal government, which in many cases replaced, but in other cases became a parallel form of government to the traditional government. In some reservations, and what happened was that the government established a tribal government, supposedly. And, like, I lived up in Vinatai, Alaska, where we had the IRA Council, the Indian Reorganization Act tribal government that was established by an act of Congress in 1936. We have the traditional council, which are the traditional governing system of the Athabascan people since time immemorial. And we have the Dorion, the Native Alaska Native Corporation that was formed as a result of the Alaska Land Claims Native Settlement Act. And all three are some form of government of one peoples. And they often make conflicting decisions. It's been one of the real destructive processes on reservations, the creation of separate and therefore conflicting bodies of leadership. And a lot of times the IRA Council has the backing of the FBI and the United States government to enforce things that are in opposition to the traditional tribal leadership. It's a real complicated history. Most people don't realize some experiences that people just don't understand. One of the issues that I lift up has to do with crime on the reservation. A criminal offense committed on an Indian reservation is investigated. Who do you suppose, if someone is murdered on an Indian reservation, who investigates it?
In the tribal council.
The tribes can investigate civil offenses, but criminal offenses on most Indian reservations are investigated by the FBI. Know that?
No. Why is that?
Because it has to do with federal jurisdiction. Well, I'm talking about criminal cases by non-Indians. Okay? Criminal cases by non-Indians on Indian reservations is investigated by the FBI.
Yeah.
Okay? Indian cases are investigated by the tribe, but criminal cases are investigated by the FBI.
Because we've read a lot in the Wenatchee world about getting that all straightened out. And it's really better for me not to get a speeding ticket in this field.
That's right. That's a civil offense. And the tribe, like if you are driving on an Indian reservation, and the Warm Springs is one, if you ever go to Warm Springs, don't speed. Because the tribe, that is their jurisdiction.
They've got 300 years to get even with us.
That is their jurisdiction. And when they say the speed limit is 15 miles an hour, they go 15 miles an hour. Because it is a tribal place.
There's a magazine called Pacific Northwest for you to read, and it has an unbelievable article about a proposed highway from Moclips on the Pacific Ocean beach up to New York. Are you familiar with that?
They call it the Quinault Tribal Highway.
Mm-hmm. Well, a bridge has been built here, but this road can never be built because of the difficulties of some Indians having sold some land to whites and limited access to this federal road would cut off access to.
Are you talking about the road that goes north and ends at the next town north of Moclips and then stops? Uh-huh. And then it starts again on the other side of the Quinault Reservation?
Yeah.
That part of 101 that was never completed because they went across the reservation. And there is no
solution to that. It's like the Irish situation. Well, it's hard to believe we're still doing it to you.
Most people don't realize when you see on a map an Indian reservation that oftentimes up to 60% of that reservation is owned by whites.
I think this article said 5% of the land in the Quinault Reservation is owned by whites.
And that has to do with the history of what we call the trust. What happened was that the government reserved the Indian land in trust and said, if we give you title, you'll lose it. Greedy people will take it. So we'll supervise it for you. We'll keep it in trust for you. And in the Dakotas, their idea of keeping it in trust is interesting. They lease land for far, far less than its value to whites and get 99-year leases and that sort of thing. It's changed, but you know. Anyway. It's hard to talk about the Dakotas than I thought it was. Okay, I got off of my book. We only have not too many more minutes, so we just take another couple of questions.
Are children now being educated in their home communities? They're not being removed now, are they?
Well, there's a lot, there's, for the most part, Indian children are raised, get an education near their home. But in some areas, like on the Navajo, there still is problems with transportation that are so serious that in some cases, children are still in boarding schools.
But their educations are comparable to non-reservation education?
There's no blanket answer to that. Depends on the place. In some places, no. In other places, yes.
But are most kids brought up with more ideas about their background? Or does that come from the family or the school about their Indian heritage?
I believe that that a fair characterization of the way kids are being brought up on the reservation is a vital and positive Indian identity, a vital life, a sense of Indian that's stronger, ever increasingly stronger, vital, positive, hopeful, one that encourages self-esteem. It's a process, a changing process. It hasn't always been like that. Yeah.
Is the language being retained on the reservations? The only one I have any acquaintance with is the Hopi reservation. And there, the language is a dying language. And once the language dies, the religion is going to be gone. Because there's no way that the...
It's a major issue because there was major steps forward in preserving native languages with the Bilingual Education Act and some things like that. And this administration has virtually destroyed all of that sort of program. And so it's a serious problem still, preserving the languages.
Now in this case that I'm speaking of, it's turning for a whole circle. Originally it was the whites who took the children away and insisted that they don't speak the language, not hear it, they sent to school. But now it's come round the full circle where the school is on the reservation, but the people themselves do not want the local language. They want English taught only so they can get educated, so when they go away to boarding school, they have the chance to make it and to go on. And so it's become a vicious circle for them themselves.
They're looking more at the way of survivalist mainstream.
Yeah, right.
And that's not a uniform position at all.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, there are those people who believe in raising their children in a traditional way. And there are those people who believe that Indian children should know the traditional ways, but also know the ways of white America and be successful in that too. And then there are those that see no purpose in learning traditional ways and who leave the reservations and who raise their children away from Indian culture.
Is that unique to the Indian or not the Vietnamese or the Australian culture? Vietnamese people kind of living some over trying to retain their language, trying to preserve learning ours.
It's how do a people respond to the situation that exists in America, that if you preserve a unique cultural identity and racial identity, and particularly a language, that you experience such discrimination that your life is really difficult. And how do you make life better? Like, I was not raised a reservation Indian. For a long time I felt really badly about them because they were reservation people who really, do not accept people who did not grow up on the reservation. But when I meditated on it, I realized that my mother, and I was in a situation where I couldn't talk to my mother about it, But I realized that that my mother, like any mother, would have. She didn't want us to be experience the kind of poverty and racism and suffering that has been experienced, particularly in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, which is one of the most difficult places to survive. And for a child like me, who was a half-breed, it's very difficult. And so it's a matter of survival. And so it's hard to say that people are not preserving culture because they don't want to preserve culture. It is more of an accurate, fair characterization to say people are not preserving culture in order to survive.
I wonder, also, this is not so much a survival thing, but to a certain extent, if you look at Jewish people who are so dispersed throughout so many other kinds of people, and there are a lot of Jewish people who are very traditional, they keep kosher, they do the Sabbath, they go to synagogue. And there are other Jewish people who are Jewish just because their grandparents were Jewish, but culturally they're very mainstream. And I would imagine with the Indians there's a lot of a real wide variation.
Before I let go of you, the image of a spiral dance then is that we've touched down like a butterfly touch on information that and cultures and people that are that you've just, you know, sort of picked at just a little tiny bit of it, you know. There's a real danger in taking the subject as broad and diverse as Indians and talking about it. And you need to know that as you come around and you yourself experience the Indian people that live around you, if you can see them somehow in a new way, be aware of what's Indian in your life. I asked you to sort of, as you listen, bring up your own images of what Indian is. We talked about it in our opening group, like you have images of the Cleveland Indians, and you have Tonto, and you have Chief Sealth, and you know, what are the images of Indian in your life? And as your journey on your life, as you travel anywhere in North America and Central and South America, there are original native indigenous peoples everywhere, a history there. And as your lives touch them, I invite you to learn more about them, to make relationships with them. They exist today, and there's so many opportunities for you to be an advocate for those people, to show leadership to the congregation and communities that you're a part of, to reach out and learn about and exchange. You can be an advocate for people. What we've been able to talk about is so, you know, so much of a sampler, a taste, and an eagle's look, and you know, you don't get the details and the perspective and the answers unless you zoom down and really get into it.
Look at generations. I have a 5-year-old grandson who just loves Indians, and we introduced him to a little boy who has an Indian mother. And our neighbors across the street are part of it. And he doesn't feed like that at all. They live in houses.
I mean, I have Lutheran pastors who come to me and want to know if those Indians live in houses, you know. I have little Indian children who in my life had said to me, you don't scalp people, do you? And I said, no. And they said, this little 5-year-old kindergarten girl said, neither do I. You know, can you imagine what question had been put to a 5-year-old child that she wanted to know if I scalp people so that she could tell me that she didn't either? My little girl, who is part Indian, came home from school, and my son, he came home from school on Thanksgiving with this wadded up brown paper bag. It was a brown paper bag stuffed with newspaper, and they had crumpled it all up and twisted it and held it up like this. I said, what is that? He said, it's an Indian. I just cried. I just thought, how can I raise him?
That's what I wondered, how you're finding it possible to instill any of, you know, the traditional at all for your children. For
well, I think society is changing. I think we're all becoming proud, but it's too late. There's nothing left.
Well, I'm here to say that Indian people are alive, and we have survived, and we will survive.
There's a dam down by Panaji that has a lot of native people. I mean, there are good things.
Yeah, there are a lot of good things.
There's also the Omak Stampede, which is here.
I think this touches on something that's so tragic about American history as it's been taught in our school system. Now I'm a teacher, now a substitute teacher, but I would never teach history in the way in which I see it in most textbooks, because I think there's a story to be told there that hasn't been told. And every one of us has some contact with the public school system, and we need to address that question to our principals and superintendents. We must say, what's going on here? What are we teaching about the American history? How can we find a way to tell everybody's story, not just the white man?
And we need to educate ourselves first, because we don't make use of the opportunities we have. I was just briefly on the Hopi reservation for a couple of months, but I was so aware how the majority of visitors that went through, there were probably more from Europe, Germany, and so on, for whom the American Indian culture is really something they don't experience at all, so they're attracted to it. Then there were people right from Arizona, for instance, and yet I have lived overseas in a number of places, and I have lived there, and you could feel that you were more in a different culture and people than you would in many overseas places where you go and stay in Hilton hotels and all this kind of thing. And yet we don't even, you know, learn or take any opportunity to be part of, as you say, this. I mean, the Indians are still there, and the whole way of life is so different that we know nothing about, and they're right big beside us often, and we still know nothing about.
I guess that, you know, that is the point of the ministry that I think is really needed, that every one of us, and I've said this, and I'll have to do some research. I can really, you know, promise you that this is true, but I think every single person in the United States lives within 200 miles of an Indian community, a living, breathing, viable Indian community. That you can reach out to and that you can care about. Once you realize life is sacred, their lives are sacred, they should be preserved. Knowing them is a sacred experience. It is something that is important. And knowing that they are family with you. I invite you to pick up the article in the Reserve Library or buy it at the bookstore called Visions of an Inclusive Church. We are family with each other. And when we set our table, there is a place that God has made for Indians and Blacks and Asians and Hispanics.